I think Instagram is kind of like when you're walking your dog down the street and another dog is walking the other direction, and there for that brief moment you're just yelling at each other. And podcasting is more like taking those two dogs to the dog park, and they have a lot more time to hang out, sniff some butts, and they end up being friends. I think that's kind of why the podcast format is a little bit better. Welcome back, team, to another week, another, I guess if you're listening to this day of, this will be another Sunday with Drew and Alex, another fireside chat.
Also, shout out to all the people who listen to this first thing on their way in
first,
to work on Monday
what
morning.
What time do these go?
They publish
live?
Early, so like they're available all day Sunday, but I think our biggest block of listeners all at once are the people who listen to it on their way to work Monday morning.
Interesting. It seems like we got some good feedback. I don't know if you got any negative feedback from the commentary last week on people who reverse into their parking spots.
I did get some feedback, actually.
I know Emma. Shout out Emma. Emma was a fan.
Connor, you're getting a live on air shout out, but my chaplain says he's going to ensure that he backs into every parking spot from here on out just to piss me off.
Well, there's only one place that he is going to go then when he dies, and that is straight to hell.
Sorry,
I'm kidding.
Connor.
Shout out chaplains. I did a thing this week though.
Uh-oh.
You're supposed to say, what did you do?
What'd you do?
So this is right in line. People, so if people have been following this podcast for some time, they'll know that I've been, really in 2024, I've been on a quest to stupefy my iPhone and make it dumb and not enticing. And we've talked about, I put it into black and white.
We had a whole debate about whether black and white and grayscale are the same thing.
So it's in grayscale / black and white. Instagram's not on there. YouTube's not on there. This week, I deleted my emoji keyboard.
Ooh.
I don't know where that came from.
I didn't even know that was a thing you
I didn't
could
either.
Do.
I didn't either. So I've been reading a lot more, maybe because my iPhone's in black and white. So I've been reading a lot more in the evenings. And this is going to be really existential right here. But I was reading these books. I'm reading a book by C.S. Lewis at the moment. And I was like, man, words are really, like, people that are good with words are really, like, I can appreciate that. They're really cool. And I think I was texting with somebody as I was having these thoughts. And the text had just sort of devolved into emojis. I was like, what am I doing? Like, I'm sending hieroglyphic cartoons to somebody. Like, this is ridiculous. So hopped right up onto my high horse, Googled how to delete your emoji keyboard. And sure enough, you can do that. So if anybody out there wants to join me in this quest to stupefy your smartphones, delete your emoji keyboard. And if you text me, I'm not going to be able to send you an emoji back. There have been a couple of times this week where my thumb has gone to like the place where the emoji thing would be. It's not there. So I have to respond with words.
Interesting.
Did you get an iPhone
have
yet?
Have you found your vocabulary expanding already? Or
typically I'll just reply and say laughing face or
I don't think that accomplishes what you
thumbs
think
up.
You're accomplishing.
Well, it's we're moving in the right direction. We have evolved from hieroglyphics into Sanskrit, and we're working towards Oxford English. I'm working on it. This is like the third day. So
you'll get there eventually, Drew.
We'll get there. But yeah, guys. So this week's episode is a little bit different. You want to go ahead? Go ahead. Introduce us.
Sure.
To us.
Well, I don't know if we're going to introduce us. We will at least introduce what the episode is, and that is kind of a flipped interview where our guest is here to ask us questions, and most of those questions kind of center around what we're doing with this platform. We have Brandon Huttman back. He was the guest on our third Reel episode.
Friend of the pod.
So throwback all the way to 2 years ago. We are approaching our 2 year anniversary. That's coming up next month.
Time flies.
So 2 years into this adventure, Brendan's back to ask us what we've learned in the process, what we're trying to accomplish with this whole thing, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And I realized as I was answering the question, one of the questions he asked us that, and I think folks will pick up on this. I realized I have a really douchey morning routine. Did not know that until I said it out loud.
Drew, despite his effort to make his smartphone dumb and his lack of engagement on social media and things like that, Drew is much more of a stereotypical fitness influencer than I am.
So it would seem. But yeah, we had talked about doing this episode for a long time. I think it is for me at least, it does feel a little bit weird to be interviewed on your own platform. But I think having now done it, and especially handing the reins over to Brendan, I couldn't think of a better guy to do it. So for people that are new to Mobs and Mo's, or people that have been here for a while and might not know Alex and I very well. Hopefully this provides you a little bit of insight and a little bit of, what's the phrase? How the sausage is made, maybe.
It's
So.
got some of that. It'll also be for those who prefer more structured content, you will find that Brendan came to our podcast much more prepared than we come to our podcast.
Way more prepared. He like repped stuff. We don't typically do that. Good on him. So enjoy.
So what I did is I made a list of a bunch of questions and then I kind of categorized them.
It's more than we do. You're better than we are.
Let me give you guys the categories. So the lightweight questions are more like personal
For
questions,
Alex, lightweight.
and that's
Oh, I
like
see. Okay.
hey, we could start a natural place to start is for us to talk about, and Alex, you can go first. Like, what's your training routine looking like right now? Like, what are some things that you're into? Like, that's a
Those kinds of questions.
under kind of that personal category question. We've got some other ones. I've talked to you guys a little bit about this. My interest is more hearing about what you guys have learned as a result of doing the podcast, right? So next category is podcast learning, and that has to do with, talking a little bit about, your audience as well as some of the ways that you guys have personally gotten better. The next three are, I think, are going to be a lot of fun. The first one is going to be, and these two kind of play together. It's like governing body of strength and conditioning and the professionalism of the industry kind of playing together. And that really has to do with, some of the conversation you guys had with Scott Caulfield recently. And then the final category has to do with strength and conditioning philosophy. So kind of digging into some of the beliefs that you guys do have just based on, your experience and some of the things you guys are reading and obviously people you're talking to. So those are the categories that I'm kind of going to work through here.
I'm impressed.
He's already coming on our pod more prepared than we are for any pod we're on.
I'll tell you, Alex, I'm not sure how far you drive to work, but I'd say Drew and I spend a lot. I spend more time than Drew because I'm about 15 minutes past Drew's unit to my unit. And so honestly, what I did was, on my way to work, I just got the voice recorder out and really kind of thought about what are some things that I would want to talk to you guys about.
Dang.
We met recently and I got to ask you guys a few questions, but similar to most of the time when we get together, I'm just curious about what you guys are learning.
I need a voice recorder. That's a good idea. Probably write a whole book in there.
You're in the Apple ecosystem. Aren't voice memos a whole thing? You already have it.
Yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah. So that's kind of how I did it. Spent some time last night just thinking about, what's a natural way to, talk about this and really let's do this. So, I kind of started Alex asking a little bit about, I think a natural place to start is just, what's your training program looking right now? What are you into? What's working? What's not?
Yeah, I think like most people, I'm balancing a few competing demands at the moment. I recently failed to follow my own advice and gave myself some IT band syndrome stuff by progressing my trail running volume too fast. So I'm gradually easing back into running. The hardest part was you have to actually like not run for a little while. Made it through that part, and I'm into the gradual progression back into running part. So I'm able to run a few times a week again, and then. It's ski season, so I'm skiing roughly every weekend, something like that. Some weekends I don't. Sometimes I do a little more. Like I got President's Day weekend coming up. I'll be skiing a bunch. And then finally back in Colorado, joined a climbing gym, climbing a couple times a week, and then filling in the rest of those gaps with more normal strength and conditioning stuff. And the last one I'll add, because people are always looking for like how to train kind of content, and I want to be knowledgeable on that stuff. So I have like experimental portions of a lot of workouts where I'm like trying stuff I see other people doing that I'm not familiar with. Shout out Alec Blennis. He's where I get a lot of ideas from in terms of like stuff I haven't necessarily tried in terms of exercise variety and things like that. So kind of balancing all those things at the same time. I do this sounds like a shameless plug. Foundation of some of the workouts is long and strong workouts if people are hyped up for that.
We
So definitely do some of that.
Yeah,
But definitely modifying some of those to fit all those other things in there too.
so Alex, you have like a Monday through Friday or like a set routine, or do you have sort of like a revolving schedule where you kind of know you got 10 training days, and you just kind of keep rolling through those regardless of what day it is, or talk to me a little bit about that.
It's more people have heard like the big rocks thing. Like you put the big rocks in the jar first, then the medium rocks, then the little ones, and the sand fits in around it. I put my big rocks in first. Those are usually skiing and or climbing, outdoor activities, stuff like that. Because those are kind of my top priority. They make me the happiest. So I put the big rocks in, and then like structure, strength stuff around that. So I'm not going to be like not doing like leg day immediately after skiing or something like that. Make it all work out and then fill in cardio after that, because that's usually the most flexible and doesn't get in the way as much.
Yeah. Are you morning workout guy or afternoon?
This is evolved a little bit recently.
He's got a girlfriend now, so
I mentioned it on the Instagram.
Afternoon guy.
I used to be like a hardcore afternoon guy. Like half the reason I got off of active duty is because I was always grumpy waking up for morning PT. And that's weird to say because I kind of love PT in general, but did not love the morning workout thing. But now, fast forward like 3 years since getting off of active duty, twice this week I've been done with my run by 6:15. So like it's a little easier when it's like voluntary and you're making the choices. So I'm starting to ease in a little more morning training. As many people like to discuss, it is easier from a schedule standpoint if you just knock it out at the beginning of the day and don't have to think about it later. So maybe or maybe not optimal for training stimulus reasons, but it works.
Yeah. That's awesome, Drew. Your mic.
What's my training routine? Man, I'm going through a pretty bad program hopping phase right now. For the last several years, which sounds like a long time, but literally for a couple of years, I had been training for this make-believe Power Man event that I made up, which was, I think I've talked to you guys about it, but
it's been mentioned on the pod, but not.
Yeah, I think so too. So effectively, for people that hadn't heard, it was basically this dumb idea I had where I was like getting into the hybrid stuff. And I was like, what would be like the ultimate hybrid thing? I think it would be a powerlifting meet smashed into an Ironman. So you do your one rep deadlift, or no, I forget the exact order. I think it was deadlift into this.
I think it was, yeah, you got it right.
I think
yeah.
It was deadlift into the swim, into a squat, into a bike, into a bench press, into a run. So it's one rep maxes for all that. And then, so I literally trained for that for years. And it was fun because doing that, I think, exposed me to a lot of different programming philosophies that I still use. But what was interesting was that when I did it, and I did a half Ironman distance, I didn't do the full, but I did a half. When I completed it, one, it sucked. I'm pretty sure I got rhabdo. But
weren't
then
you pretty messed up on the run when you did the half distance?
Pretty messed up. I saw the bottom of, I saw hell, which was interesting. But off the back end of that, man, I had just was like, and I think that was maybe a year ago, just was so unmotivated to train for the longest time. I still did it. Generally, my anxiety associated with not training is what drives me to train now these days. And then also just trying to prepare to beat up any of my daughter's future boyfriends. That's another driver of mine. So it's a very long, circuitous way of answering the question, which is, what am I doing now? Like I said, I have been doing a lot of program hopping. I'm easily swayed by people on Instagram that kind of like, oh, this is like what I'm doing. And like, I'll pay the $25 a month or whatever and try it for a month. Usually after the third or fourth day, I'm like, dad, this is dumb. I don't want to do it anymore.
I know a good program you could try.
Long and Strong. Yep. I do. For people out there, like I would say 75-ish% of the Long and Strong workouts, I do them before I write them. And then the other 25% are just based off of things that I've done in the past. But right now I'm just doing a pretty basic hybrid template with general barbell stuff and just some basic endurance. I have found that as I have gotten older, putting a lot more intentional, like plyometric explosive power type stuff at the beginning as part of the warm-up has been really helpful. When I don't do that, I just feel like everything hurts. And then as a New Year's resolution, I have tried to commit to doing yoga every day, which has been awesome. I've probably held to that about 95% of the time. There's a couple of days where I've missed it, but that generally I think is kind of the backbone. And then I guess on top of that, playing an absolute crap ton of golf. So that would be my skiing and climbing equivalent of what Alex is doing. I'm just schwacking golf balls.
Yeah. Are you guys spending time, like, you know, do you plan your week ahead, or are you just kind of waking up and winging it, kind of know where you're going to go for the week in your own minds?
I don't know if other people have this, but like you kind of have like the first day you're going to start a new program feels like Christmas morning, and like you're pumped. You're like, like Monday, like I'm getting after it Monday. I'm going to write out my whole week, and I'm good for that for about a week. And then by week two, I'm just going day by day. But I use Training Peaks, which makes it pretty easy. That's not an advertisement. That's just kind of what it ends up being is like before I get in the gym, I'll just program it so that I'm looking at it on my phone.
Yeah.
For me, before ski season started, I was pretty steady on just like following the week the way it was laid out on Long and Strong with minor modification. I usually had to move Monday because I was doing some sort of long trail thing, whether it was a trail run or a mountain bike on often Sunday. So that would mess up Monday, but otherwise I'd follow those weeks. Since ski season has started, I've been less sticking to the order of the days and more fitting it in around the big rocks.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's good. I mean, I think the reason I bring that up is it feels like the longer that just generally speaking, the longer you work in a profession, the less time you have to kind of, you know, get into whatever Excel or whatever programming tool you're using and like kind of plan it out or buying programs. And you sort of just figure out what's going to work for you and how to sustain your fitness. And if you got a goal trying to be a great skier, then start training towards it, you know?
Oh, I'm not even trying to be a great skier. I'm just trying to be on the
mountain. Oh, come on, man.
I thought you were right. I'm not even trying. I am. I've made it.
I'm the best skier on the mountain.
I am Alex Vaughn.
Hey, so I got to ask you. So I'm guessing that we all get up pretty early. You guys have any rituals or routines that you guys do before getting out the door?
Yeah, so I get up at 4:15 on the dot, take a picture of my watch, post it on Instagram. Then I ice bath and sauna at the same time. No, it depends on whether or not, like, usually I get up around 4:15 every day, weekend or otherwise, just because I like it. I like being up early. Sometimes that'll change. Sometimes I'll sleep in, which this makes me sound like a douche. It's like sometimes I'll sleep until 5:30. But back to the yoga thing, like literally the way I've been able to stick with it is I will wake up at 4:15. I will brush my teeth. I will walk into the other room and just plop onto the yoga mat and start doing. And it's only like 15 or 20 minutes. It's not like an hour thing. But then it's the usual stuff, coffee, smoothie, and then I'll usually have a bigger breakfast a little bit later. But and I'm a to answer the question you asked earlier, I'm a morning workout person for sure. So I like to get it done.
Well, apparently, unlike the other people on the call here, I do not enjoy getting up early. I'm not a very good fitness influencer. I don't have much of a routine in the morning. Most of my routines revolve around putting enough obstacles in the way that I don't just get back in bed and hit snooze for a while.
Put your phone like in the other room.
So that's what I do. Not only is my phone in the other room, my phone is downstairs. So I have to get out of bed, walk out to the stairs, walk down the stairs, get to my phone, turn off the alarm. And hopefully by then, the part of my brain that comes up with reasons to go back to sleep has chilled out a little bit. And the part of my brain that remembers my plan for the morning from yesterday is awake and ready to go.
What time do you go to bed?
Depends on the day. I go to bed relatively early. Try to be in bed by like 9:30 or something. It varies, sometimes earlier, sometimes later, depending on how hyped up I am on mops and mows, how many fights I'm in on the internet, whatever.
We talked about screen time already with you.
Hey, man, I know. Relax.
You got. Oh, man, come on.
But I get more specific, if I'm working out in the morning, I'm up at 5:30. If I'm not working out in the morning, I'm up at 6.
I have started journaling in the morning too, actually, which has been really nice.
Drew, why are you not running the Instagram page? You're like the stereotypical fitness influencer. Just do it.
Well, I found, and this goes back to the New Year's resolution stuff, which I don't know, for some reason this year was really helpful for me, but operating off of a to-do list, not like a minute by minute, but just, you know, a quick sort of journal of where my mind's at and then two or three things that I want to try to knock out throughout the day. Like that was huge. So add that to my guru morning before I have my chaga tea and my athletic greens. No free ads.
Yeah. I mean, we could probably talk about that time management piece, you know, for a whole episode too, because kind of find yourself getting to work and all of a sudden, if you don't have the deliberate list of things to do or projects you're working on, it's like you can just kind of be swayed the whole day, be stuck in your email.
Exactly.
It's real.
So Drew, do you listen to any podcasts on the way to work?
Oh man. Here, let me open it up. I've already mentioned the Dolly Parton podcast series I was listening to. Absolute banger. Loved that one. Big fan of Dolly. This week it's been Freakonomics is doing a multi-part series on Ralph Fineman, for people that don't know. I guess by the time this episode comes out, this will be well in the future, but I do listen to podcasts. I'll be honest, I haven't listened to a fitness podcast in like forever. Lately, it's been a lot of golf type stuff. Just for people that are into the golf space, there's a lot of drama going on in professional golf that makes for some good listening. And then, yeah, I mean, really, it's kind of, if I scrolled through my most listened to podcasts, it would be the golf stuff, the daily. I listen to a lot of rugby content just because it's my favorite sport. History That Doesn't Suck. That's another great podcast series. So it really just kind of depends on the day.
What do you have to learn about golf?
Dude, man, like with LIV and golfers like jumping over from one league to the next and drama. Like, yeah.
Sounds like a lot of drama, Drew.
It's a lot of drama. Yeah, which is, I'm sure, so healthy to just have that.
Drew has a morning routine with some yoga and some journaling.
Right.
Drew loves the drama. Why is Drew not running the social media?
Because my phone's in black and white and I've deleted Instagram.
It's dude, not conducive. I've been doing that since we met a week ago or whatever, the three of us. I saw you were on Grayscale. Been doing. I'm just getting frustrated. I just turned it off because I was getting super annoyed.
God, you got
to
stick
with
it.
It does make it harder to find apps because you gotta get used to the color of the logo and stuff.
You don't even look at your phone anymore. My screen
mine just goes Grayscale at 9 o'clock at night. And it's like, hey, go to bed.
You're at the level where your phone is telling you like, hey, you should probably put me down and like go outside. Like the old Wii.
I'm absolutely
playing the Wii. After a while, it's like, are you still playing? You still doing this?
Alex, where are you at on podcasts? You listening to any?
For sure. I have a couple fitness ones in there, but like Drew, I think I listen to more non-fitness in the podcast space than I do fitness. Been super hyped on 90 Pound Rucksack recently. It's like a limited series, so it's not going to go on forever. But if anybody's interested in like mountain warfare, 10th Mountain Division history, stuff like that, it's Christian Beckwith. It's awesome.
What is the relevance of the 90 Pound?
Here's what's up. Christian has already agreed to come on the podcast. We just have to schedule him at some point. You'll hear all about it.
But why 90? Like, why not 80 Pound?
It's just from the training they were doing at Paradise Camp. It was a quote from some leader. I don't remember exactly the details, but yeah, it's from a quote. Other stuff, very much non-fitness related. Blocked and Reported is a fantastic podcast on like political issues that other like platforms will not touch because they're too sensitive. The Daily and Up First from NPR are probably my most consistent ones. They're daily, they're short, they give you the news, that kind of stuff. And then my fitness ones, usually Stronger by Science, although their content has been like a little different lately since Eric Trexler left. The vibes are off. I don't know what that is. Greg Knuckles is still great, but it doesn't have the banter vibes it once had.
You listen to Mops and Mouse? I guess you edit it. You edit them, so you hear them.
I listen, not only do I edit every episode before it airs, I also listen to every episode after it comes out to make sure nothing went horrifically wrong, and it's where I pull quotes from it to put on the Instagram.
That's fair.
And despite that, despite listening to every episode at least once, and some a couple other times, I'm still not in the top 0.1% of fans of Mops and Mo's. I'm only like 0.5 or 0.3 or something.
You'll never beat my mom.
Apparently.
Hey, so since you brought it up, let's talk about Mops and Mo's.
Hey.
So, quick question for you guys, and just kind of throw this out. Bring listeners up to speed, number of episodes, how long you've been doing it, maybe a little bit where it started.
I think you texted us to ask number of episodes the other day.
95,
and
right?
I haven't actually pulled it up and gone through it all. I'm just doing the math based on the number of weeks we've been on the air. Early April will be our 2-year anniversary of the podcast. So counting backward from there, like that would be 104 in early April. So I think we're at like 95 right now, something like that.
Recording this one, we're at 95.
No, if you count the ones we've like recorded that are unpublished. So like at the time we are speaking, sorry, audience, we're at like 95. By the time this comes out, we'll be closer to 100.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where's the start for you guys? Like, where's the idea coming from?
Whose idea was it? Was it my idea?
To actually do a podcast. I know I had wanted to do a podcast before you and I talked about it. Yeah. I know that because I have like a picture in my phone from like way back in like the early days of the Instagram where I had already bought a microphone. And I now regularly get questions from people of like, how do you start a podcast? What do I do?
Buy a microphone.
And my best advice to people is like, originally I would have told people like, buy this book that tells you a little bit about it and like figure out whatever. And like, here's the software you can use. I would tell people none of that. I'll tell people just start recording stuff, like start figuring it out by doing it. Like nothing will accelerate your learning process as much as making an attempt and figuring out what your limiters are. Cause I like that microphone sat next to my computer for more than a year before Drew and I got around to doing this. But our bonding and decision to start a podcast mostly started around JFK's The Soft American.
Yeah, that's a good point. Forgot about that.
Yeah,
that's true.
So Drew, Alex comes to you and says, let's do a podcast. What are you thinking?
Well, no, I think I've told this story before, but I had given a brief, where was this where you guys were at?
It was on Teams. This was during COVID.
During COVID. Yeah, I got connected through a mutual friend to give a brief at the fitness school virtually. Mm-hmm. And I remember I put a lot of time and effort into this brief, gave the brief. And then when it was over, I think it might have actually been Alex that was like, hey, so like it never flipped past the first slide.
He had a bunch of data slides that like.
So I had all these slides and on my computer.
Because he never made like clear slide transitions. He just started talking.
I just started talking. So these people thought I was just presenting off of one slide, which I don't know if that's like a flex or. So anyway, I think we just kept talking. After that, I don't remember how we got from there to the podcast.
If I remember correctly, after we did that chat, you let me know that you were already in the hiring process to come on board with H2F.
That's
so you
right.
were super curious about Army Fitness and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked because of that. And then you got hired, you got to Fort Bragg. And then I was getting out of the Army. And I think it was like when I was driving up to DC to do my like career skills internship as I was leaving the Army that I stopped by Bragg and visited a few people.
Walking that's right. Your office. Yep. You're in my office. And I had, JFK
the Soft American framed on the wall. Mm-hmm. You had a bunch of textbooks that we talked about how bad they were.
Mm-hmm. And then we were in love. And that's when
it is. We fell in love in that moment. Really what happened was Drew was great. Cause this is like the same time I'm like getting my CSCS and transitioning into the industry and stuff like that. And Drew was the first one to be like, hey, listen, everything you've been taught so far is wrong.
Close the door. Close the door. Let me tell you a trade secret. It's all wrong.
It was great.
But we just started talking. I mean, we would record. I think we have a couple of episodes that we just never. And then I know, Brendan, you were one of the first. Nate Palin, we just kind of went to a close circle of friends and started having conversations. And back to Alex's point about telling people how to start a podcast, like I think we recorded maybe 10 episodes before we actually launched anything.
Mm-hmm. Because I mean, we threw away a good half of those.
Yeah, and we churned through the backlog pretty quick. So, yeah, it was just one of those things that we just sort of started. And I think it was the right time and place in terms of how embedded human performance was taking off in the conventional military. People just started to listen. So
I'll also say it's important to discuss this. I think the Instagram predates the podcast by a couple of years.
Yeah, that's true.
And I was growing progressively more frustrated that it is impossible to have nuanced conversations in the short form formats that people consume on social media. I had to hit people with the hot takes. I had to be hyperbolic. Like you can't include a lot of nuance in there. So there was an existing desire to do longer form content where we could actually dive into the nuance of the issues we were discussing.
I think Instagram is kind of like when you're walking your dog down the street and another dog is walking the other direction. And there for that brief moment, you're just yelling at each other. And podcasting is more like taking those two dogs to the dog park and they have a lot more time to hang out, sniff some butts, and they end up being friends. I think that's kind of why the podcast format is a little bit better.
So in my learning process of doing podcasts, I've learned that you have to be on the lookout for when the pull quote happens in the episode that you're going to snip out and make the intro of the episode.
Sniffing butts.
You're marking the time. Yeah. The
there Instagram is like sniffing butts. Podcasting is more like, anyway. Yeah. So I think we answered the question.
Yeah. I was going to say, Alex, you mentioned walking in Drew's office. Alex, I remember you walked into my office too. Mm-hmm. And I remember that it was awesome. Really enjoyed talking to you. And that was kind of like when I first met you. And then I met Drew through a mutual friend. Same mutual friend,
by the way. All three of us. Trisha.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Trisha was the one. We're trying to get her on too.
Future podcast guest. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the first things she told me, she's like, oh my gosh, Brendan, I have this guy named Drew that you have to meet. He's coming to Fort Bragg too. I was like, hey, great. Shoot me his number. Like, you know, I'm down for it. It's cool. Let's do it.
We fell in love.
So I got a question, Brendan. I think it was you. So that was like the first real conversation we had is when I visited your office as I was leaving active duty. But I think it was you I think it might have been before you were hired or just as you were getting hired, you were like visiting Fort Bragg to like walk around and see 20th Engineer. And I think I was still teaching Master Fitness Trainer at the time. And we had like, we pulled a couple rowers outside in the sun and we're going over rowing technique. And you walked by like looking at what was going on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. I made a trip out to Fort Bragg. I really, you know, I don't have a background in tactical. And so for me, it was important to, you know, before I signed up for the mission, right, is to see, you know, see what it was about. I knew that it was going to be different than my background in pro sport. But it was important to me to come and to meet the people in the organization and you know, to get a feel for the culture. And ultimately, I decided 20th Engineers was going to be a great culture. I was super welcomed in. I mean, the folks showing me around had a full agenda for me. You know, it was great. Great experience. Can't say enough about it.
I didn't even know we could do that. I thought you just said yes or no, and they offered it to you, and then you did the background check. So good on you for doing a site visit.
That was back when that little conference room, like it was the beginning of that being a gym, a couple squat racks, few rowing machines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, about a 2,000 square foot brigade annex that's now kind of the brigade's primary place to do awards and different, you know, potlucks and things. But at the time, 2,000 square feet and super small office. We outgrew that space quickly when we had
the
five
like
people.
Tech office that is back where the projector would be if it was, times.
An old cinema.
No, but it's cool. It's cool. It's all good. We've come a ways from there. I know a lot of other H2F programs have as well. So I want to know, guys, you guys have had at least 95 people or more high performing folks on the show. I want to know about, are there any like unifying characteristics of these folks as you kind of reflect on having people on the show where you go like, oh man, I think like most of the people kind of have this skill or trait that, you know, makes them good in their space and contributes to, you know, good outcomes for soldiers.
I think we have maybe unintentionally or intentionally migrated towards contrarians in some sense. Sometimes we intentionally seek that kind of thing out, but more often than not, just I think the nature of the conversations we have, we end up landing people who think a little bit outside the box. And this isn't necessarily a knock on your standard fitness podcast, but you do kind of see a lot of the same names doing the same circuits and kind of talking on each other's shows, and it's fine. But, you know, I think about kind of the John Kiley's, the Newton Chang's, even like highlighting some of the researchers, because that's not often a population that gets platformed very frequently, I don't think, in this industry. So yeah, I would say that the unifying characteristic across most of them is that they either are thinking about things slightly differently, or they're just thinking about things in general, whereas some folks are just more inclined to copy paste.
I do think I was going to say roughly the same thing, but I was going to say it in a little bit different way. I think the kinds of people we end up bringing on the podcast are the type of people who do not, like when they are told this is the way you do it, they'll listen to that, but they're not going to assume that it's true just because somebody told it to them or they read it in a book or something like that. It's a brand of person who is consistently asking questions about why is it this way? Is this the best way it could be? That kind of stuff. I think that's what we seek out. And I don't know if have we discussed rule number one?
I literally was about to ask, should we mention rule number one? So we do have one rule with this podcast, which is that if you ask us to come on, the answer is no. I don't think that applies as like some of like people we know and like mutual friends, whatever, it's a little bit different, but we do get hit up occasionally from either the individual who wants to come on or weirdly like a rep of some sort who's like, hey, I think David would be a great guest and here's why and blah, 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 blah.
It is a little weird for people out there. Like once you have a podcast that has enough traction that people know it exists and it has a signature on the internet, you'll start getting like PR emails of like, my client, Steve, is awesome. Here's why you should have him on your podcast. And Moms and Us did not operate that way.
So that's rule number one. It's really the only rule.
It's the only one. We do not have a rule number two.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the longer you do something, the better you get, the harder it is to get better.
Oh, we're still pretty bad. We got a lot of room to get better.
As time goes, like, what are you guys doing to stay creative with the podcast? And, all the way from, modifying your format to, finding unique guests, to shooting out, the quotes and things like that.
We'll see if Drew agrees with me. I do not think we have a lack of staying creative. I think we're pretty good at creative. I think we're pretty bad at basic processes. We essentially lack a calendar. To date, we don't record, we don't keep any of the video, and we need to start keeping the video to produce some social media content. There's lots of things we want to do that we just like don't have the processes in place to be as efficient as we could be. So I think our room to grow is less around staying creative and finding interesting guests. I think we have a wealth of people we want to bring on. I was just like bugging Drew the other day because he came up with another guest we should bring on. I was like, listen, man, we have like five people who've already said yes that we haven't scheduled because we have no idea when we're free. I think processes are where we hope to improve.
Yeah, I mean, I hazard to even call us creative. I think the bar for creativity in this space is just pretty low across the board. And again, I'm like saying that tongue in cheek, but like, yeah, I think it would be different if we were in like marketing or something where you do have genuinely creative people. So I think one of the things that has worked well in our favor is we enjoy talking to each other and talking to other people. And if you put a microphone in that environment and record it, then great, you get some cool conversations. Yeah, the processes piece, not very good at it. We've sustained it up until now just fine, I think, in some sense. I do have a massive amount of just audio memory on my computer that is committed to podcast content that I should probably get rid of at some point. But as far as the guest thing goes, I mean, honestly, like we exhausted our own network pretty early on, and we've revisited some of those people, and there are some I think that we could still bring on, but some of the most interesting folks we've had agree to come on, I think we've just like found on Instagram,
Like some
or
of it's
we've
come out of the blue, like would
totally
not
come
have
out of the
predicted it.
blue.
We didn't seek out the folks. I will break the third wall and say that like to the audience, Brendan has been helping us with some of our processes. He's much better at
Yeah,
that stuff than we
Brendan's a
are.
process guy. We're not.
I will also say we can attribute to Brendan the number one episode of 2023, which is Emma Palace. We didn't know who she was or seek her out. That came from Brendan. Tyler Fillion, the number two episode of 2023, was because like I happened to be going to Fort Moore and was there checking out cool Ranger Regiment stuff, and we ended up in a meeting with him, and then he DM'd me on Instagram later when he saw like the Ranger Regiment stuff on Mops and Mo's. Like the best episodes are kind of accidents where like the right people have like had an interesting
Well,
idea and brought it
and
up.
some of the episodes we get most excited about don't really,
Yeah.
I mean, it depends on how you define perform well, but like the listener numbers aren't necessarily that high. But like there's some episodes we've done in
I
the
thought that
past
NASA
that.
stuff we did was some of the coolest content we've ever done. Like, I absolutely loved it. It was fascinating. Got to learn how professionals operate in a space like that. Some of the factors you have to consider to do these basic things in microgravity is incredible. But apparently, the audience does not agree because they were not that into it.
Speaking of audience, I know Alex, you mentioned, really kind of where Mops and Mo's started was Instagram, and I'm guessing that, you get that you do get negative feedback, but hopefully you're getting some
Once in a
positive
while.
feedback. I want to know what some of the most valuable positive feedback that you've gotten through interacting with the audience through a platform like Instagram.
I've had a bunch of this stuff recently, positive and negative. Drew and I were joking about it in some of our banter in the intro to the episode we recorded yesterday. I've had a few people express that they really value that, like, I do interact with the audience. Like, I take their feedback, I have a conversation with them, I reply to their messages.
That's why he has
And
trouble waking up and
no, it's a huge
sleeping.
problem for my mental health, but at least it's good for the audience.
Saves me from doing it.
And I think there is value there too. Like I learn about things that I wouldn't learn about otherwise. People stay in the conversation. The audience feeds me things I would not have known. Those are all really cool. And I'm not super thorough. Like the audience will know, like my most common response to a DM is I'll just hit like on the message and move to the next one because there's too many for me to have an actual conversation with everybody. So apologies if I've seemed flippant by just like sending you an emoji and moving on, but that's kind of the
K just
bulk of
gives
some
him
of
a
those
K.
interactions. Yeah, I mean, it
Yeah.
is what it is, man.
K.
Other feedback that's been good. I mean, I really appreciate, and I've said this from the beginning, the most value I derive from this podcast. Like if this whole platform was gone tomorrow and I had nothing, what's the value I got here?
Friends.
It's from the people who tell me when I'm wrong and explain why. Because I'm wrong a lot. And I've gotten some really, really good feedback.
I was gonna say I'm never wrong, but no, that's not true.
And Drew, I was gonna ask you about your involvement on Instagram, but I know Alex does it.
Yeah, I don't. I had the password for a little bit, I think, because I was using. I do all the web development.
He had the password for a little bit. He used it so infrequently that, like, the one time where he like accidentally logged onto it, I thought the page was getting hacked.
He thought the page was getting hacked. Was
changing passwords and like clearing caches and doing all this stuff.
No, what happened was I didn't even log in. I bought a new computer. And I went on Instagram, and for some reason, it logged me in on the Mops and Mo's account. And then I get text from Alex, because you might have been on a plane or something. And so a little while later, you're like, somebody hacked the account. Like, oh my God, the world's burning. I was like, hey, actually, I think that was me.
Because I have like two-factor authentication in place and all this stuff. We hadn't had any issues. And all of a sudden,
the
place it pinged from was North Carolina, but it wasn't Liberty and it wasn't where Drew lives. It was like far enough away that I was wondering about it. I was like, oh God.
It's because I'm just living that VPN life.
Yeah, man.
But that's actually not true. But yeah, I think I don't do any of the social media stuff. I do the website stuff. And for folks that have tried to like friend request me, I made my Instagram private a while back, and I still haven't quite figured out how to balance like accepting friend requests and who's real and who's fake. So if you're just like sitting in the queue, I'm sorry. There's
I'll
nothing for you.
For the same. There's a reason I have a public facing page for public facing stuff. A lot of people end up adding my personal page, and if I don't know you, I don't accept it. Sorry.
Well, there's also nothing to see on my personal page. But back to the original question, I am always a little bit, I think, surprised, like pleasantly surprised. Like we'll have people come on who are way more accomplished than us, like super high ranking people and or just super accomplished people. People are doing phenomenal things. And once we're done recording, like they'll thank us for coming, like, thank you guys, like for what you're doing and blah, blah, blah. And it's still, I mean, I get that, you know, there's a lot of content in this space and strength and conditioning and social media and workouts and all these crazes. And like, there's a lot in here, but I do think that we've in some sense carved out a niche where like, hopefully we're driving some intelligent conversation that's hopefully contributing to maybe policy change down the road or just a more intelligent way of training human beings. And so when you hear people that have accomplished so much more say like, hey, what you guys are doing is like really, really good. That I think has been probably the most pleasantly surprising thing about this whole experience.
The craziest to me is when a guest comes on, especially when it's like somebody like really high profile that we had to like hunt for and get in the podcast and stuff. And they've listened to like our three or four most recent episodes before coming on and have stuff to say about it. That blows my mind every time.
That is cool if they listen. And you get the Ellen Langers, and I'll give her a shout out because I'm pretty sure she doesn't listen to us, but like we had her on.
No chance she listens to it.
We thought that this was going to be like, she's a huge deal and she accepted way too easily. Like it was one email. She's like, yeah, when are we doing it? I was like, holy shit. And so she came on, the window open, she's on Zoom just like this. She goes, okay, just to be clear up front, I want to be the mindfulness expert for the Army, and I want you guys to help me be that way. Let's record and do this. And we were just kind of like, okay, here we go. So that was fun. I think she's been our most energetic guest off the cuff.
Most energetic and most willing to tell us when we're wrong.
Yeah, she held no punches, which was great. We had a blast.
Fantastic.
If you're okay when people tell you you're wrong and you're getting some feedback from audience, anything you guys have changed your mind about could be like philosophical based or training ways. But anything you guys have sort of gone the other way on?
I'll do a couple. I mean, easiest, scroll back to the first like 10 posts on the Instagram page. And I probably disagree with most of what was in the content. I think that's pretty fair to say. It was all me like regurgitating CSCS stuff that I thought was interesting and the audience would like.
That's a great way to be wrong.
Yeah, it was good. One, and there are a few folks at Fort Liberty who will probably enjoy me saying this because we've had this fight on the internet a few times. I haven't completely changed my mind, but I will modify where I stand on it a little bit. I have said from the beginning that I think if you're going to be in tactical strength and conditioning, you should be prepared to develop and deliver programs in extremely austere environments, whether it's like a patch of dirt, piece of parking lot, pile of sandbags, like you should be able to deliver something really good. And I still think that is true. But like the more I see these programs operate, the more I realize that like participant or service member belief in the program is the driving force behind the outcomes that they get. And their belief in the program is going to be heavily influenced by the venue it is delivered in and the veneer of awesomeness that you put on it. So if you like, I will acknowledge like providing facilities that are sexy and cool and things like that will dramatically accelerate the organization buying into the program and caring about it and investing in it. So I'll put like a minor twist on what I said at the beginning.
Yeah, that's good. Anything else come to mind, Alex?
I'll have to brainstorm. I'll let Drew talk for a little bit while I figure out what else I've changed my mind on, because I'm sure there's plenty.
I mean, I think the big one for me, and it's not necessarily a mind changing thing, more of a double downing thing. And it's kind of what Alex just mentioned, which was that like a lot of what we think matters really doesn't matter. I had already kind of been churning through that myself in previous years as a strength coach. And I've said this before, I'll say it again. A lot of that came from reading John Kiley's stuff. I think having a lot of people on who have been very successful training human beings and hearing how they go about it and thinking, and this is not to discredit them, but for a lot of those folks, they think that their approach is the way. And for them, it has been a very successful way of doing it. But when you collect enough of those case studies and you realize that there are many, many, many ways of training people, and the one common denominator is like what Alex just mentioned, there's a lot of buy-in, there's a lot of belief in the program, there's this whole kind of psychosocial factor behind it. I think casting a wide net with different types of guests outside of just tactical strength and conditioning and seeing that pattern replay itself over and over again has helped me kind of double down on that belief. And it's changed the way that I think I communicate with young strength coaches. And I could probably be a little bit better about this, but like, cause they'll ask you like, hey, like, how do you do this or that? And typically my answer is like, it really doesn't matter. And I know that that's not what they're looking for. And it is not what I would be looking for if I were in their position. So it's an interesting, it becomes an interesting thought experiment when you kind of boil it down and figure out that the things that you think matter really don't matter all that much. So I have to think of like a really big mind change. I guess
I'll give you a chance to think, because you give me time to think of a few.
Well, I have one, but you can go if you want.
Well, Drew gave me enough time to think of three. One, I think when I started this process, I was very, very interested in physical fitness specifically. And in the process, I now value more so physical fitness as a gateway to other kinds of fitness and wellness and health. I wouldn't necessarily say it's like more or less important, but I see it more as kind of that access point where you get into other things. Similarly, at the beginning of this, I was very, very interested in program design, the nuances of like writing out a program over days or weeks or months. I don't know if it was when the podcast had started or before. Yeah, when the podcast already started, I was still a 5-3-1 fanatic. I loved when people like asked me for like workout stuff and I could just pull up my 5-3-1 Excel calculator and like punch their stuff in and give them 3 months of programming and look super smart. I no longer prioritize that the same way I used to. And then I think it was like between Drew and Evan Picon, the explanation of how people get progressive overload backwards. It was like the stress you applied in the past that allowed you to do what's in the future, not increasing stress somehow forcing you to adapt. We don't have enough time on this episode to dive into that one too deep, but I've completely changed my perspective on that one.
Yeah, I remember that aha moment for myself, actually.
It hurt my brain, yeah.
I don't know if this is a mind change thing as much as it is just sort of an eye-opening realization thing, which is that I think as an industry, as a strength and conditioning industry, nobody really has any idea what's going on. And there isn't some savior from on high, either senior ranking or intelligent, that's going to guide us as a group. And I think one of the things that comes with having a podcast and a platform is that you do start to receive just a lot of like, I don't know if you want to call them like opinions or just ideas or things, like people, you get to see and hear what people are thinking kind of across the industry. And you realize that a lot of us are thinking the same thing. Like, I think a lot of coaches know how to train athletes, and they realize that it is different from what everybody is taught and kind of what we are meant to believe, but nobody really seems to be doing anything about it, or they just don't have the platform to be able to do anything about it. And similarly, when you think about something as specific as like tactical strength and conditioning, and I guess I've been in the tactical space for a while before I started with this, but you do go into some of these things kind of naively hoping that everybody's on the right page and everybody has the same end goal and everybody, you know, I'll use the buzzword, like people first. And then you realize that at the end of the day, it's actually not people first. It's very much like a money driven operation. And that's not, again, that's not to discount any of it. It's just the nature of the world. And so I think realizing that all of that is going on in the background. And so then having something like this, not to like put Alex and I on a pedestal, but to allow for conversations to happen with other people who are saying the same thing, but might not have the platform to say it louder, I think it becomes a little bit more of an important tool. So not a mind change so much as like a realization, I think.
We've been batting around a change to the tagline. It started out as changing the fitness culture of the force, and that's still like what's on the Instagram page or whatever, but
make fitness great again.
Oh, we batted around a few, like modernizing military human performance, but like the phrase critical conversations keeps coming up. I think a lot of what we do is take conversations that are already happening behind the scenes in tons of organizations like this and try and put them in a place where they can happen front and center, where some people need to hear them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know when Scott Caulfield was on the show, you know, director of strength and conditioning at Norwich, former NSCA, you know, director of education.
I did just hear from Scott like today or yesterday, I think, that he got his invite again to write chapter 15 of the next Essentials edition.
Oh,
well, we got you know, you guys were able to pull the curtain back a bit.
Yeah, in we didn't ruin it so much that he got uninvited even after what he said.
But really, you know, kind of talking about, and I think Drew, you were pretty open about talking standards for strength coaches and kind of asking the question and talking about why is there really just seems to be like one central governing strength and conditioning body of the NSCA. And I think what you were trying to also recommend was maybe a new way of doing it.
Mm-hmm. I think it sucks.
So if you had the choice, yeah, this is great. If you had the choice, what are some of the changes that you would make?
I say that somewhat jokingly, but I think that the issue or the challenge for me is that, and I can only speak to tactical human performance. I don't know if this is the exact same in professional sport or collegiate sport or Olympic sport. I mean, you would know better than me, but I would imagine that it is, just based on conversations we've had. Like a strength coach has to be able to sit shoulder to shoulder with a surgeon, with a physical therapist, an athletic trainer, like professionals that have to do a significant amount of work to be where they are at, whether that's board certification, medical school, all of these things. And you're making decisions about athletes. And the strength coach, by virtue of the bar that we have set and how low it is, which we've mentioned this before, it's just an online certification, like bippity bop, cool, you're a strength coach now. It's a very low bar, and other industries know that and recognize that. I mean, I know a lot of ATs that have their CSCS. I know a lot of PTs that have their CSCS. I don't know a lot of CSCSs that have their MD or their PT or their AT. So, I mean, it doesn't go both ways. And so what that effectively means is you're now in a conversation with a group of professionals who think, for better or for worse, think that they can do your job because they have the same letters that you do at the end of their name. And at the end of the day, like we've already mentioned, programming for human beings isn't that difficult. If you can just get them to buy into what you're doing and you make educated decisions about maybe we shouldn't put that much weight on the bar and maybe we should like fix the form a little bit. So I think the bar is just too low. And then as a result, you get these second and third order issues when we talk about like, hey, we aren't getting paid enough, or hey, like, you know, there's not enough jobs available or what have you. I think if we professionalize the whole space, whether that is a board certification or whether that is a little bit more synergy across the different international bodies. We've talked about the UK Strength and Conditioning Association on here before. I know the guys up in Canada are doing some really cool things. So it's not to necessarily bash the NSCA. I think we just do that because it's kind of a low-hanging fruit situation. But because they have assumed this mantle of being the voice of the industry. I think it's kind of beholden upon them to raise that bar and kind of move us away from, I'm going to trigger some people here, but like move us away from the gray sweatpants society on Instagram and into the world of like medical performance, like sports medicine, human performance. That should all kind of be the same thing. Because as far as I can tell, until that happens, we're never going to see a world where we can attack something as big as the public health crisis and the obesity epidemic, because realistically what a lot of those people need is effective strength training, but they're getting fitness recommendations from their doctor because as a society, we hold the doctor up so high. The strength coach, we get confused with the personal trainer at the YMCA. And so I would just like to see that shift. And I don't know how that shift takes place, but I think for all of us in this industry, it would be a net positive if we just kind of raise the bar a little bit. And I'll get off my soapbox now and turn it over to Alex if he has anything.
I mean, I got a couple, and I'll do two weird disclaimers. First, talk to my dad about this stuff a lot. His career has been in chemical engineering and supply chain management mostly, and then like the tech side of supply chain management later on. And so that's a lot of governing bodies that he's interfaced with and certificate programs and things like that. And he pointed out that in every industry, he doesn't know anything about health and fitness and stuff like that's not an industry he's ever interacted with, but he would point out that everywhere, whether it's like Lean Six Sigma or whatever it is, they're always at least a decade behind actual best practice in the industry. So I don't necessarily think there's some magical way we're going to make our industry different from the rest of the industries where the certifications you have to get are just really out of date. That's fine. It is what it is. And then another one I think about a lot, when I was in college, we visited a bunch of like news organizations in New York City. And like we had this meeting with Brian Williams, and somebody asked him about like all the It Bleeds, It Leads stuff, like all the stuff that the news shows just to get people to watch the news that they know is not necessarily quality news. And Brian Williams' response was, if you don't care about the business of the news, then you don't care about the news. The only way we can do the really in-depth investigative reporting is if we do enough of the stuff that gets people to turn it on in the first place to get the money that funds those projects that really matter. And so I understand that reality for governing bodies in these spaces is you have to make the industry viable, not just try and perfect the knowledge and things like that, because you might lose your whole business in the process if you focus too much on that stuff. So I understand that. How would I like change the industry if I had the keys to the kingdom, like Drew always says in the closing questions of the podcast? I think one would be coaching certifications should probably include practical coaching somewhere in the process. I think that would matter. And I would have a serious conversation about prerequisites. Like the tech industry right now is going away from like requiring college degrees and you can get trained in the actual thing rather than a bunch of arbitrary prerequisites. And meanwhile, this industry seems to be going in the opposite direction. To be an athletic trainer, you now have to have a master's degree, strength and conditioning. They want your degree to be in the field, which would make me no longer eligible to have a CSCS anymore. Same. And a bunch of other great coaches I know. I know some amazing coaches who don't have a bachelor's degree, so they're not going to have a CSCS for a variety of reasons, life circumstances, focusing on other things, whatever. I won't share names because I don't know if I'm like clear to share this story, but the one of the guys who won strength and conditioning coach of the year for the NFL, we got into that space before the CSCS was a thing, and he was then forced to go back and get a CSCS to keep his job once certification standards came into place, despite already being at the top of his industry. So I think some real serious considerations of what prerequisites actually matter to being effective in the space. I don't know what the answer is. I just think there should be a conversation.
Well, I know, Scott also talked about the PBS CCS, which is the Strength and Conditioning Coaches Society in Major League Baseball, and the effort there about 10 years ago to raise the standard for things like what you wear to the meetings. Mm-hmm. Those coaches started, wearing, at least a sport coat and slacks and a nice shirt. If you wanted to wear a tie, it was good. But what are some other ways that strength coaches could increase the professionalism of the field? But just using that as a starting point example.
I think a big one for me is being more transparent with what they're doing. And we've talked about this. I think with Keiichi, we talked about kind of the research, like the gap between research and practical application. And I'll reference one, you know, a product we've referenced a number of times, which is the, I think it was a 10,000 meter speed skater from Norway. And he basically like published everything he did to win that gold medal. And you kind of can dig through his training logs and all that. And it's fascinating. That to me should be kind of the backbone of what I think of when I think of strength and conditioning research. I think if coaches were more transparent about what they were doing, if their training logs were more freely available, not in like any sort of weird public domain way, but it was just encouraged that people would sort of talk and discuss programming and not assume that like I have all these proprietary secrets that I can't share with you unless you buy my ebook or, you know, pay for my monthly whatever. I think that would go a long way in just introducing some quality control and then maybe bringing the entire industry's ego like down a couple pegs. I think that there's this weird relationship, coach athlete relationship that you see happen a lot where like, as a coach, I'm this like magical wizard and you come to me because you want to know my magical wizard things. So I go into my cave and I write this beautiful program and then I hand it to you and you go do it. And if anything goes wrong in that program, it's your fault. Like you've screwed up as the athlete because my program was perfect when I handed it to you. I think that that does a disservice. And just by virtue of not having those conversations, we then lose some of the nuance that I think is required to sit in that room I was referencing earlier alongside those professionals that I think are in industries that do require a higher level of quality control. So to me, I don't think that that quality control piece is something that needs to come from the top down, from like the NSCA down. I think that that's something that we as kind of professionals in the space can start to encourage. So maybe, you know, who knows? Maybe there's a world that exists where we don't go to a conference and learn another stupid set of plyometric drills for tactical athletes or how to foam roll your shoulders after a deployment, because like, what a waste of everyone's time. I would much rather see us as coaches talk about why we program the way we do and talk about some of the influences that we have. And here's the athlete that came to me. Here were some of his, you know, biographical information. Here's kind of some of the things that he did on some of the baselines I gave him. And here's the program. And let's kind of pick that apart and talk about it. Like that to me would be really cool versus, again, just somebody with a lapel mic talking about why a lacrosse ball versus a golf ball is like a better foam rolling tool.
So my answer to this one is a little bit different by nature of my different perspective and how I came to this space. I think this is part of why the dynamic works for the podcast in that like,
I just get really cynical.
Drew kind of represents like the strength and conditioning industry in like a traditional way of coming to be a coach. And I don't frankly consider myself a strength and conditioning coach just because I have the letters or whatever. That doesn't make you a coach. Actually coaching does. And I actually served in the military, so I have a little bit of a different perspective on that. And I think this one is kind of the military's fault just as much as it is coach's fault. We like publish a whole slew of data about how bad we are at something, and we talk about how important bringing this in is and stuff like that and what it has created. I think this has gotten a little bit better recently, but especially at like the beginning of H2F, a ton of coaches came into it with like, this program exists because the people running fitness for the military are idiots and they have no idea what they're doing and they should just listen to me because I am an expert. And it just doesn't work. Like if you walk in the door with that attitude of like, hand over the reins to me, I know what I'm doing. Eventually I will educate you enough that you might be allowed to do a little bit, but like, why aren't these stupid soldiers listening to the expert in the room? I guess it's just not going to work. Like there's plenty of coaches that are smarter than that. Like it doesn't come from like a place of professionalism. It comes from like maturity, I think, and like an understanding of social contexts and meeting people where they are and realizing that you're going to have to integrate with this culture, not the other way around. And yeah, you're hopefully going to change things, but you can't change things until people like believe that you care and see you as part of the organization.
Well, and I think the coach, like, and I might butcher this, but like the coach, the strength and conditioning coach to me sits in a very unique place in that they are the most accessible to mm-hmm. the athlete in whatever sport, tactical, professional, whatever. And I've seen this play out a number of times. Like the coach, the role of the coach is always kind of the tip of the spear when it comes to the rest of the human performance team. Like when a soldier or an athlete goes to see the medical staff, they're kind of going in like that is a world that they don't really understand. And they're sort of handing the keys over to those people and just sort of trusting what they tell them to do. And I think with the fitness piece of it and the role that the coach plays, there's room for a lot more back and forth and more of a relationship building aspect. And so I think kind of back to one of your earlier questions about what I would change about strength and conditioning, I think if we acknowledge the massive role that like psychology plays in our profession and nutrition and even some of the injury prevention stuff, because what I've seen play out over and over again is that athletes feel very comfortable talking to their coach, whereas they might hold back from the mental health expert or the doctor or the PT.
Or even their uniformed leadership.
Or their uniform leadership, right. And so I think if as a as an organ or as an industry, we can sort of latch on to that. And then kind of back to the joke I was making about the conferences, like bring some of those people in, because I would love to hear a conversation or a presentation from like the world of psychology, or I would love to be a little bit smarter on nutrition so I could have some of those conversations. But you then get into this whole messy idea of like scope creep and how dare you tell that athlete that like rice is a carbohydrate, you're not a dietitian, shut your mouth. Like that stuff to me is just horseshit.
I'll close out the thing I said earlier too by saying a huge piece of it is in the contracting side of this whole game. And I'm not an expert on contracting. I've tried to stay as far away from contracting as I can. I've only been involved in it on a very superficial level. But the way the contracts are written and the way the job descriptions are written are based pretty much on NSCA scope of practice type stuff for what a strength coach does. And that's just not what the job is in a tactical environment. It is not write a program, come in with a clipboard and whistle and run people through that program. It's a completely different thing. And I think part of this process is we have to update that impression and make sure it's communicated clearly to people who are considering jobs in this space.
Yeah, for sure. I know it seems like, Alex, I heard you say, you know, physical fitness is the gateway, right? And yet at the same time, the conversation normally is around strength and conditioning salaries not being high enough. My question is, you know, what's holding back the industry from getting those salaries to a certain standard above where it is currently that reflects strength and conditioning being the anchor for this holistic system?
I think we're starting to see it happen. I think you're starting to see more, especially in the military, GS-12, federal civilian strength and conditioning positions, which is on par with a lot of what the allied health professions are seeing. That's not widespread, but it's starting to happen. And I think it'll become more widespread gradually.
To me, I think it just goes, it's a supply and demand issue. Like if your bar for being considered a CSCS is so low that you flood the marketplace with people looking for jobs, there will always be somebody who will take a position that pays less than what you want it to pay. So, I mean, this is like a tale as old as time and sort of the labor industry, but if we want higher salaries, we have to either limit the supply of coaches, or you have to find a way to kind of, I mean, I'm not advocating for a union necessarily, but you have to kind of find a way to, as a collective, basically advocate for yourselves. And I think it's bad here in the United States, like overseas, it's even worse. I remember in grad school, looking at some of the jobs in the UK, and the bar to be eligible was much higher. In a lot of cases, you had to have a PhD, and they were paying like $50,000 a year, which is insane. So it could be worse, but I do think that it could be a lot better. And to me, it again just comes down to supply and demand. Like until there are not people there who are willing to work for whatever it is, $30,000 a year, contracting companies, teams, whatever, they'll pay. I mean, they would rather have you do it all for free. The fact that they have to pay you is kind of unfortunate for them, and they're going to want to pay you at the lowest possible number that anybody's going to take. So I think if you raise the bar for what it means to be a strength coach, you can start to have higher salaries as a result of that.
I'll layer in some bureaucratic nonsense too, going back to the contracting thing. And again, I'm not an expert in this one, but I do know that there's been some shift. Everybody talks about lowest bidder in military contracting, but there's a shift in a lot of these towards LPTA, lowest price technically acceptable. And I don't think we've done a great job articulating what technically acceptable means for coaching. I think it's very hard to define that, very hard to enforce that. But when you can't define what technically acceptable is, it reverts to just lowest bidder.
Yeah, I know when I hear you guys talk about that, I think about value. What are the ways that strength and conditioning coaches can provide more value than they are currently? Because you're really talking about quality, quantity, cost, and time as the factors of value. Interested to hear you guys recommend a couple ways that that coaches could do that.
Just add value.
Yeah, add value. Like the bottom line is, if you think about it, if a strength conditioning was so good that a unit, a team, an organization couldn't do without him or her, the bottom line is they would figure out a way to raise the salary to the point where they could keep that person. So the bottom line is, unless you're delivering enough value, you're just falling into the group. So what are some ways that strength conditioning coaches can add value to their organizations so that they can fight for those higher salaries?
I mean, I think it's kind of hard in a tactical world because you add that layer of like contracting and all that kind of thing. I mean, like when I hear you ask that question, I think of thinking of your background in like a baseball team or any professional sport team, it's like there's kind of a direct connection between the person who holds the purse strings and how much they want to be able to pay you. I mean, obviously there's some nuance there, but like with contracting, it's different because the customer, being the military, says, hey, we want this service. And then they throw it out and the company decides what that's going to look like. So to answer the question, I think kind of from my opinion, a lot of this for me goes back to what I've sort of been soapboxing about this whole time, which is that you have to look for things that are tangential to reps and sets and barbells and assault bikes. And like, you have to become that psychologist. You have to become the person that the leadership of your organization recognizes is kind of the glue guy. Like that's the guy that all the other guys or gals go to either talk about stuff or troubleshoot different things and blah, 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 blah. I think really good coaches become that person. And you'll hear, I mean, I think in Brett Favre's retirement speech, like he named his strength and conditioning coach because that person was so pivotal in his career. So I think that there's room for coaches to be able to do that, but it does require you to kind of take a step back from thinking, again, you're this sort of magical guru that has all the answers, and be a little bit more approachable and accessible for your athletes. And I think maybe the last piece that I would add to that is just having a more robust knowledge about those things that are secondary to reps and sets. I mean, we've talked about kind of the medical space, and I don't think coaches should be able to perform open heart surgery. You should be able to have a conversation with a doctor about like basic human anatomy. You should understand different injury mechanisms and things like that so that you can riff back and forth with a physical therapist. So when that becomes part of, I think, your daily kind of your workflow, then you've become more important for your organization.
This is just going to echo Drew. Very similar idea. I think contracting makes this hard because, I mean, you have a list of duties you're supposed to perform as a contractor, and you're not supposed to go outside that list of duties, but we're basically saying the best way to do this is to go outside that list of duties.
Yeah, like legally, you can't add nuance to your job.
Yeah, but I mean, we all know how this game is played a little bit, and I think a big part of it is by nature of being the most accessible ones on the team, by nature of being the ones on the ground, by nature of physical fitness being the access point to the rest of this, the coaches are going to have a pretty good idea of what's going on and where the limiters are and what the problems are. If you can come up with a potential solution to that, and it might involve you going and finding somebody you don't traditionally work with or proposing a new way of doing things or whatever it is, I think you're in the best position to figure out the solutions to problems that are outside strength and conditioning. Start working on those problems.
Well, like here's a metric. I've played around with this at work. Like I think it would be cool to be able to track. I mean, because, you know, the military talks about suicidal ideations and mental health and all these kinds of things. It'd be cool to me if you could implement a metric that tracks referrals to behavioral health that came from a strength and conditioning coach. Because I think what you would find is that a lot of, because I mean, this has happened to me. I've had people come up to me throughout my entire career and tell me things that I would then refer and say, hey, I think you should talk to, you know, so-and-so, whoever's sitting in that role, whether it's a social worker, cognitive performance, behavioral health. And that has fostered a conversation, and then that has fostered treatment, and ultimately like that person kind of gets better. So that to me is a very easy way of showing value, because again, thinking about this from a tactical standpoint, you can think that you're very valuable, but until you can showcase that on a PowerPoint slide, unfortunately, you're not really that valuable. So that's, I mean, just thinking about metrics like that, and I'm sure other people could come up with other ones, but that is a great way, I think, of showcasing kind of the holistic nature of this type of team and the role that the coach plays in that.
Yeah. And I think where I'd go with that is the example, many of the examples provided were more X's and O's of strength and conditioning, right? I would also say a lot of value in the complementary skills like communication, leadership, modeling behavior, building relationships, mm-hmm. right? If you aren't an effective writer and you send bad emails to Army leaders,
yes.
that is not going to be received great, right? If you're unclear about what you're asking for and you leave it very ambiguous, it's not going to play good, right? If you are asked to give briefs routinely and you don't have a mental framework that the Army clearly has, people will struggle to follow you. If you're someone that's not modeling behavior that's consistent with high performance, it's going to be very difficult to get full buy-in, right? And then the last one is building relationships that are based on trust. Mm-hmm. And I think that buys you the opportunity to get some airtime for people to listen to you. And once you get that, I think you guys have said it, in my opinion, then you become the go-to expert for all things, you know, quote unquote readiness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. Anything else on that topic, guys?
I'm good.
I mean, I have a lot of things, but I'll leave them.
Gotcha. You guys get to choose one piece of equipment for your weight room. What are you guys going with?
I know mine, because it's been asked, you know, if you're on a desert island, you can only do one exercise or whatever. I would say, okay, I was going to say pull-up bar. I could also see an argument to be made for like kettlebell, I think.
Kettlebell was the first one that came to mind for me. I think I might change it to sandbag for a goofy reason of God, I can change the weight of the sandbag.
You're so tactical.
Like I can have a single piece of equipment and like fill it and empty it. I think I could do more. Like not like a army sandbag with a knot at the top, like a one with like handles on it, like the gym style sandbags. But that's what I would,
not with the knot on the side.
That's what I would probably choose.
Guys, where's the profession going in the next 5 to 10 years? What's coming up?
Oh man, there's probably two ways you could go with this: optimism and cynicism. I think cynically, I would say nothing changes. Because nothing really has to. I mean, again, this kind of goes back to the contracting thing, and like we could go on and on, but I would like to think that in 5 to 10 years, we've sort of elevated the requirements and kind of raised the bar. And I would hope that happens at the lowest level and not just by adding more requirements on top of that. And what I mean by that is, and I'll reference CrossFit here, like, cause we just did an episode about CrossFit. With CrossFit, you look at the history of it. Originally, they just had the level one. And for them, that was the thing. If you were a level one, then they considered you to be qualified to be a coach. And instead of, I think what they realized was that they needed to have a higher level of like education, intelligence, whatever. And so they just added certifications on top of that. So now there's a level two, level three, level four. But unfortunately, that level one still allows you to do most of the things that you would need to do as a quote unquote coach. And I think when I think about strength and conditioning, sure, you could add a CSCS 2, 3, 4, but if at the end of the day, the customer, in this case, the government or whoever, professional sports team, still just has that CSCS as their thing, you haven't really raised the bar. So I would like to think that we would do as an industry just a better job of raising what it means to be a coach. And then maybe, I don't know, from the top, like from the NSCA or whoever it ends up being in 5 to 10 years, just the messaging around how to ingratiate the strength and conditioning coach into some of these sister industries, whether it's medical or physical therapy, just more crosstalk versus setting up silos and not even taking part in each other's, you know, conferences or research or whatever. And maybe the last piece I would add to that would be, man, I would love to see strength and conditioning research just be a little bit more relevant to like the day-to-day strength and conditioning coach, whether that's just changing the nature of what it means to conduct peer-reviewed strength and conditioning research or making space for, like we talked about, training logs and just things like that, doing a better job publicizing those things so that they're more easily accessible. I think that would be really cool. And then lastly, I think every coach should make $1 million, but I don't know if that's going to happen.
Love it.
Mine's a little different. I've echoed Drew on the last couple of questions. I'm going to go in a pretty different direction on this one.
Please.
And I'm going to start with...
Wait, were you talking about strength and conditioning as an industry or Mops and Mo's as a podcast?
An industry.
Okay. Sorry. I thought for a second I went in a totally wrong direction.
And I'm going to start with saying, when you said the industry, I thought a little differently than Drew did, because Drew thought the strength and conditioning industry. And I know that's what you were asking about, but I started thinking about the fitness industry.
Oh.
And depending on how you define the fitness industry, it's anywhere between like a $30 billion industry if you're looking just at like health clubs and stuff, or it's like a $100+ billion industry if you're factoring in a bunch of other things. And despite COVID hitting some of those pretty hard and actually boosting others through the roof, the fitness industry continues to grow as America continues to get less fit and sicker and fatter. So it's not making the difference it exists to make, right? Like on a foundational level, we keep doing more and more of it, and it's not making outcomes better for society. I think that's a problem. Maybe it's blunting a downward trend. So maybe we're like fighting back against the inevitable, but I would like to hope we can turn the curve around a little bit. And in the strength and conditioning industry and in like the personal training industry and things like that, there's all this talk about licensure and professionalizing and upping the requirements to get into it. And yet once you pass those requirements and once you get those certifications, you find out that all that complicated stuff you had to learn isn't that relevant, and fitness is pretty simple and it's mostly lifestyle behaviors. I would love to see a move, and I don't know how to accomplish this, but a move towards lower barriers to entry, but better quality of the outcomes you're delivering, right? I think when I came into this space, I would have told you that like a strength and conditioning coach is something very, very legitimate and important, and a health coach is stupid and made up. and I've to some degree reversed that opinion a little bit, right? Like I think strength coaches are still great. I think it's amazing, but I think like there's value in the whole health coaching thing of approaching other domains that are a little bit fuzzier and stuff. And I don't think more PhDs and licensure exams is going to get us closer to making the difference in society that we want to make. But again, I'm not sure what will. So maybe somebody smarter than me will come up with it.
I think we've talked about this before. Maybe it'd be cool to see a world where doctors prescribed exercise and like insurance was somehow involved in that, so it was accessible. And to me, that kind of goes back to maybe not raising the standard, but certainly finding a way to have the medical industry think of the strength and conditioning industry as an asset versus just like those dudes over there that like to work out.
We should probably do an episode about GRIP soon to talk about what's going on over
there. Yeah, exactly. And you do start to see some of these health clinics that have, I mean, it, you know, it's effectively a gym and a doctor's clinic in the same space. Like that to me is pretty cool. And if that could become normal, mm-hmm. And again, I don't know how you do that with the way that like American health insurance and all that is set up. I don't know, but give me 10 years. I think it'd be kind of cool to see.
Mm. Yeah, it's an awesome idea. It's the idea that we're preventing some of these illnesses with just being proactive and maybe building some community around it so that it's sticky and it works, right? So I love that idea.
I'm going to test something right now. I'm going to see if the Google result is still the same as it was a couple years ago. I'm Googling the term metabolic syndrome. It says it's very common, more than 3 million cases per year. If I keep scrolling down, there should be a treatment box. Treatments.
Exercise.
Treatment consists of self-care.
Hmm.
Ooh, it has been updated a little bit. That is good to see. So 2 years ago, when I Googled metabolic syndrome, the Google primary result said there is no treatment for this condition. It's chronic. And we know that's objectively not true, right? Like fundamental lifestyle modification stuff can make a difference. And the Google result has changed to reflect that to a certain degree. Treatment consists of self-care, weight loss, exercise, a healthy diet, stopping smoking can all help. Medicines may be prescribed. And I do find it interesting that there's like a box for self-care that talks about exercise and quitting smoking and weight loss. And then there's a box for medical and it says anti-diabetic medication. I think those two blur together more than that, probably. I know Google is not a place to go for nuance, but just lifestyle medicine, right? That's what it is.
Well, I think to that point, and we don't need to belabor this, but as I envision what most people think of when they think of strength and conditioning and what most young coaches are getting into this for, they envision the weight room at Alabama or the weight room at Georgia, football. And like, that is strength and conditioning. And you see those coaches making upwards of $1 million a year. And like, everybody seems to be striving for that. And I think what gets left behind or sort of pushed to the side is what Alex is mentioning, kind of this health coach concept of where we could maybe take strength and conditioning and change the focus a little bit away from, hey, the ultimate career path is to go towards collegiate or professional sport. Maybe it's more along this medical performance model, whatever that looks like. Because interestingly enough, I think if you do that well, there's a lot more money to be made than being the strength coach at, you know, Alabama football.
Yep, it's an interesting concept and hope to see that come. And final question that I have for you guys. I think, Drew, there was one point I would know the answer to this question from you, but I'm not sure what it is now. But what is like one lesser known technology tool that you're using that's providing a ton of value in your life right now? Drew, I was going to go with your Remarkable tab at one point where you're taking those sweet notes. But I think about after the first year, I didn't see you using it. So what's on your radar?
I haven't used that thing, man. I bought, so if people don't know the Remarkable, it's like that, it's basically a massive Kindle that you can write on and take notes, and it's super cool looking and very
scary. I almost bought one a couple months ago.
So I pre-ordered one like 2 years before they launched. Like, I was in, and it's still at my desk. I have it. I just don't use it. I think that's just because I'm not really a person that like does a lot of note taking and things like that. But so one piece of technology or something that,
yeah, like lesser known, you can't say our iPhone, dude.
That adds benefit to my life.
I can give you mine Alex, for you.
Yeah, you go.
It is not a recent piece of technology or a particular sexy piece of technology. My original Kindle Paperwhite makes huge difference in my learning process. Most notably, I mean, it's all the obvious stuff. You think from a Kindle, it's easy to travel with. I don't have to wait for a book to arrive. If I want it, I just download it and I'm good to go, all that kind of stuff. But the biggest difference it makes, and I'll talk about how it makes a difference now, and I'll talk about how it completely changed the game in college. And it's for the same reason. On a Kindle, if you like long press, it starts to highlight and you can highlight a section, and then your highlights go into a log of just your highlighted sections and they're searchable and all this stuff. Man, in terms of like drawing information out of something, or like if you need to go back to something you read a long time ago and you don't really remember having that there. So I remember like in college, I took this class my senior year. So originally I was a double major, and I also decided to do a thesis. And it was becoming clear that I wasn't going to be able to do both. So I decided to drop the, or not a double major, I had a minor. I decided to drop the minor and focus on the thesis. And so I go to registrar and they're like, hey, you have all the credits, you need to graduate even without the minor. But sometimes people don't pass their thesis or finish their thesis. So we get people to take one extra class to make sure even if you drop the thesis, you're still eligible to graduate. Cool. Because you met all your requirements, you can take any class you want. It does not matter. So I took a class called The Art of War in the English department, and it was all like literature that had came from people who were in Iraq and Afghanistan. Really interesting course, read a bunch of stuff I never would have read otherwise. Super interesting. And the format for all the tests was, instructor would come in, give us the prompt for an essay, and we would have to email him a completed essay within like 90 minutes or 2 hours or something like that. You could stay in the classroom and do it. You could go back to your room and do it. Doesn't really matter what you use. But there's a clock and it's got to be in on that amount of time. And because I had highlighted stuff on my Kindle and could pull information rapidly to articulate clear arguments with references, dominated that class despite not having a background in literature. And the same applies now. Like, I'm reading, like Drew recommended Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. There is a gold, I wish he cited more of the stuff in there so I could go back to the primary sources. It's all like end notes and it's a lot harder. But there is a gold mine of like quick reference knowledge about how stress influences the body in that book. Mm. And I'm highlighting the hell out of it. And I know I will go back to those.
Once you are done, can you export that to like another program, or how do you dig into the findings?
Probably. The way I do it is I just browse it on my Kindle. You just like open the document, click the tab in the top right and click highlights. I know you can like import PDFs to Kindle. I bet you can export somehow. I just haven't gone into that too much yet.
Yeah, awesome. Drew, what do you got?
My answer is weird. And as you were talking, I finally arrived at it. And there's probably a roundabout way of getting at this. But so I don't have a TV in my house. I have a restored radio from the 1960s that has a Bluetooth enabled connection thing. So there's a number of reasons for that. I mean, having a three-year-old, you get into conversations about screen time and this sort of thing. So why I think that that benefits my professional life is because when I get home from work, or if I'm on the weekend and I have a bunch of spare time or whatever, I mean, sure, like I'll whip the computer out and maybe look at Netflix occasionally, but
we talked about from Mops and Mos.
Yeah, we talked about podcasts and music and all. I always have music playing in my house. There's music playing right now. You guys just can't hear it. And typically it's coming through that old radio, because for me, I have found when we talked about journaling and yoga and all that, like, so talk about something that brings your anxiety down, helps you clear your mind, think, you know, inspires you to open up a book, whatever, maybe do some highlighting on your Kindle Paperwhite. For me, it's that old radio. So it has nothing to do with strength and conditioning. Unfortunately, I'm the guy whose phone is in black and white and who tries to delete as many apps as I can. So I'm trying to move away from technology, but from having gone from a Remarkable 2 Kindle right on the thing tablet that just sort of sits on the side of my desk to a radio that I can just sort of use to unwind and maybe listen to a podcast or something while I'm cooking dinner, I think that in a really weird roundabout way is probably one of the most influential pieces of the technology that I have.
You guys, it's been awesome.
Thanks for coming on, man.
This is good. I did legitimately enjoy this. This was awesome.
This was fun.
Yeah, this is great. I told you guys I've been waiting for an opportunity to really ask you guys questions from a bunch of categories, from professionalism to some personal questions, philosophy, you know, digging into the governing body topic. So thank you for giving me a chance to learn more about what you guys have learned, and hopefully we can do this again.
I somehow managed to sneak in butt sniffing. So we've come full circle. So yeah, man, thank you. Hopefully people enjoyed it. Hey, Alex, let's cover our ass real quick.
Oh, great idea, Drew. All right, guys. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode. Before you go, please rate and review the pod on the listening platform of your choice. You can also visit us on our website at www.mopsinmos.com. That's mops, the letter N, mos.com. You can check out the library of podcast episodes, our latest blog entries, any helpful resources, and also sign up for our newsletter.
Drew nailed it. Just to underline a couple of things, the podcast entries have in-depth show notes on the website. So if you missed anything or you want to read any of the research we talk about, it is all there. You can, at the bottom of the website, sign up with your email and receive future updates from us. The blog posts go a little bit more in depth in kind of written form on a couple of topics we get questions about all the time. But most importantly, I just want to ask all you guys, our best way the word gets out is absolutely word of mouth. So tell your friends, tell the people you work with, anybody you think would find it useful. Thanks for spreading the word.
If you have any questions or comments, feel free to shoot us an email at either Drew or Alex at mopsandmos.com.
Or there's a contact form on the website.
Thank you.